Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to The Overlap. I am your co-host, Joshua. Will is out today. His internet's down, actually, on the day we're recording this, so I pivoted a little bit about a topic I've been wanting to kind of address and talk about. We're going to conduct a generational autopsy. So if you are a millennial or a Gen Z listener, you've likely spent the last decade and a half being told that your economic anxiety is a personal moral failing. You've been told that your inability to buy a three-bedroom house with a white picket fence is directly tied to your fondness for avocado toast and specialty coffee and an unwillingness to walk into a corporate lobby and hand the CEO a firm resume on number 20 heavy stock paper. We're told that we're lazy. We're told that we're entitled. But today, we're going to look at an objective historical math. We're going to look at the macroeconomic tape. We're going to explore how the baby boomer generation, the people currently occupying the vast majority of our political and economic institutions, inherited a flawless economic engine that systemically and systematically stripped it for parts. All right, so this is not a personal attack on your grandfather, and I'm sorry, some of our listeners I know are boomers, and if you're listening to this podcast and you continue to listen to this podcast, you're probably not part of the problem. But there is a greater understanding that needs to be pulled from this, right? We all have boomer relatives who we love and respect, and I love and respect the listeners of this podcast who are boomers, and I love and respect my boomer brethren. But we're not talking about individuals today, like I said. We're talking about a demographic monolith. We're talking about a cohort born between 1946 and 1964 that moved through the American economy like a plague of locusts with excellent credit scores. To understand the sheer scale of the generational grift that has taken place over the last 50 years, we cannot start with the actual boomers themselves. We have to start with the world that was built for them before they even arrived on the scene. We have to look at the inheritance. Imagine it's 1946. The Second World War has just ended. The United States is the only major industrialized nation on the planet whose manufacturing base has not been bombed into glowing radioactive rubble. Well, not at the time. But Europe is decimated, right? Japan is rebuilding from the ashes, and the United States is standing at the apex of a global hegemony with a unified, highly mobile workforce. The people who fought that war, the so-called greatest generation, came home and made a collective decision. They had survived the Great Depression and they had survived a global conflict. They decided that they were going to build a society that ensured their children would never have to experience that level of systemic fragility. They decided to build a fortress of middle-class security. Let's look at the architecture of that forest. The post-war American economy was built on a foundation of massive, aggressive public investment. It was an era of what you might call pragmatic socialism, disguised as patriotic capitalism. The government put in force the GI Bill, which was arguably the most transformative piece of social legislation in American history. It basically offered the returning veterans free college tuition, low-interest business loans, and really, really cheap mortgages with zero down payment. It basically created a robust middle class out of thin air. It took a generation of farmhands and factory workers and turned them into engineers, doctors, and suburban homeowners within a decade. And how did they pay for all of this? Well, that is the part that modern politicians absolutely refuse to talk about. They paid for it with the tax code that would make a modern venture capitalist probably keel over. During the 1950s, under a Republican named Dwight D. Eisenhower, the top marginal tax rate in the United States was 91%. Let me repeat that number so it can fully sink in. 9-1. Like 9% less than 100%, 91%. Corporate taxes were also extraordinarily high by modern standards. The wealthy and the corporations were essentially forced to reinvest their profits back into their workers and their businesses because hoarding that wealth meant handing almost all of it over to the IRS. So this created a big pool of public capital. That public capital was not squandered on stock buybacks or offshore tax havens like we've talked about here before. It was poured into concrete and steel. It built the Interstate Highway System. It built the Hoover Dam and the Tennessee Valley Authority. It electrified rural America. It also built a network of public universities that were the envy of the entire world. The University of California system, during the time the boomers were growing up, was practically free for in-state residents. The state heavily subsidized the tuition because they viewed an educated populace as an overall public good, not a personal debt trap. And the infrastructure that the boomers took for granted every single day of their lives was entirely funded by the blood, sweat, and exceptionally high taxes of the generation that preceded them. Let's look at the labor market they inherited. In the 1950s and into the 1960s, roughly one in three American workers belonged to a labor union. The union density created a massive gravitational pull on wages across the entire economy. Even if you did not belong to a union, your employer had to compete with union wages and union benefits just to keep you on, right? A single earner with a high school diploma could walk into a factory floor, get a union job, and comfortably support a spouse and three children or so. They could buy two cars, take an annual vacation, and retire with a defined benefit pension that guaranteed them a steady income until the day that they died. And housing was treated as shelter, not just an aggressively leveraged financial asset. In 1950, the actual median home price in the United States was about two times the median annual household income. You could save up for a few years and buy a house in cash if you were disciplined and kept a reasonable budget. And the neighborhoods were newly built, heavily subsidized by federal highway expansion, and specifically designed for the nuclear family. The boomers were born into these pristine, affordable, fully funded suburban utopias. They were born on third base, and they genuinely believed that they had hit a triple. They inherited a society where the social contract was intact. The deal was simple. You work hard, you play by the rules, and the system provides you with a comfortable, secure existence. The minimum wage in the late 1960s, adjusted for inflation, was significantly higher than it is right now. A student working a part-time summer job at a grocery store could realistically pay for an entire year of tuition at an in-state college. They didn't need to take out $50,000 in predatory federal loans at 7% interest. They just had to bag groceries for 3 months. This is the world the baby boomers inherited. It was a world of really unprecedented economic stability and massive public investment, affordable housing, free education, and a labor market that actually rewarded physical work with a dignified life. They were handed the keys to a prosperous, secure, an equitable economic engine in the history of civilization that had yet been unseen. Obviously, I'm forgetting some details, not because they deserve to be forgotten, but this was also done on the backs of Black and brown people. And, that's not the point of this episode, but I do want to honor, being that it is currently February, Black History Month, that Black and brown people were not afforded the same advantages that they are afforded now and were definitely discriminated against back then. But I digress. So they did not build this engine, right? They didn't design it. They just arrived exactly when it was running at its peak efficiency. They grew up in a culture of absolute abundance, like you would expect. The post-war economic boom created a level of consumerism that had never been seen before, right? The television sets, the cars, the household appliances, everything was designed to make their lives easier and more entertaining. They were the first generation to be targeted directly as a consumer demographic from childhood. They were told that they were special. They were told that the world belonged to them, and to their credit, they did believe it. They internalized the abundance of their childhood and assumed it was kind of the natural state of the universe rather than the result of a very specific, temporary set of macroeconomic policies enacted by their traumatized, war-torn parents. When we talk about the boomers ruining the country, right, we have to establish this baseline. We have to understand what was given to them. Because the tragedy of the last 50 years is not that things just got worse. The tragedy is that a generation was handed, to some degrees, a utopian blueprint, and they systematically voted to burn it to the ground for a short-term tax cut. They inherited a society built on shared sacrifice and collective investment and transformed it into a society built on hyper-individualism, deregulation, and debt. They were handed a functioning public sector and essentially decided that it was a burden. They were handed affordable housing, and they decided to turn it into a speculative casino. They were handed an environment, and they treated it like an open sewer to fuel their corporate dividend payouts. The world before them was built on the idea that the future should be better than the past. And the people who survived the Depression and the war wanted their children to thrive. They sacrificed their own wealth, their own comfort, to build a society that was structurally sound. The boomers took that structural soundness and they leveraged it, right? They took out a second mortgage on the American dream and they spent the cash on themselves. They pulled up the ladder of opportunity the exact moment they reached the top. The free college tuition disappeared the moment they graduated. The high corporate taxes that built the roads disappeared the moment they became CEOs. The affordable housing vanished when they decided their starter homes would be worth 7 times their original value because it had to fund their retirement cruises. This is the context we need before we begin to discuss their heyday in the 1980s and 1990s. We have to remember that every single economic victory the boomers claimed was built on the foundation of the New Deal and the post-war consensus. They did not create the wealth of the United States, right? They inherited it, they consumed it, and they had the audacity to lecture us, their children, on fiscal responsibility. As we move forward in this, we're going to examine kind of how they dismantled this utopian inheritance. We're going to look at the policy choices, the cultural shifts, and the greed that defined their time in power. So the transition from the counterculture of the 1960s to the corporate boardroom culture of the 1980s, it's kind of a stunning sociological whiplash if you follow history at all. So we established that the immaculate, debt-free, heavily subsidized utopian fortress that the boomers were handed on a silver platter. But now we arrive at the pivot. We arrive at the exact moment they decided that sharing that fortress with their children was just a little bit too expensive. The generation that went to Woodstock and talked about free love and protested the military-industrial complex suddenly woke up one morning. They looked at their bank accounts and they decided they would really prefer a luxury sedan and a capital gains tax cut. So they traded in their tie-dye t-shirts and power suits and suspended suspenders. They became the me generation. It's funny because they call millennials the me generation. And they use their massive demographic voting power to systematically dismantle the very macroeconomic infrastructure that created them in the first place. And really, it was crystallized around the year 1980. This is before I was born. The boomers were kind of entering their prime earning years. They were buying their first or second home, and they were looking at their paychecks and deciding that they were tired of paying for public goods that they had already entirely consumed. Enter Ronald Reagan and the supply-side economic revolution. And we've talked on the show before about how ultimately Ronald Reagan is the precipice of everything shitty that has come down the pipe since then. The political messaging of this time was brilliant in kind of its sheer cynical manipulation, and it's still doing it now. It told an entire generation of young professionals exactly what they wanted to hear. It told them that their wealth was entirely self-made. It told them that the government, the exact same government that built their highways, subsidized their sprawling suburbs and paid for nearly free college degrees, was actually the enemy. The ethos of the country shifted almost overnight from the collective sacrifice of their parents to a hyper-individualized doctrine of supreme selfishness. We talked about the Powell memo on this podcast before, episode 32, I think, I don't know. The blueprint for a corporate class war was written in 1971, right, by a corporate lawyer who felt the working class was getting too much power. But it was the boomer voting bloc in the 1980s that actually executed this plan. They voted for politicians who promised to slash the top marginal tax rates. They took the 91% tax rate that built the American middle class, and they took a chainsaw to it. And they gutted the entirety of the corporate tax rate. They embraced the absolute fairy tale of trickle-down economics. And the theory was that if you just gave the wealthiest people and the largest corporations massive, unprecedented tax breaks, that they would, out of the goodness of their hearts, use that money to create high-paying jobs for everyone else. It was a convenient fiction that we all know. It was a mathematical lie. It was a justification for unapologetic greed. And the boomers swallowed it whole, like really whole hog, because they were the only ones that were actually positioned to get the tax breaks while the deficits actually exploded. What happened next was a plunder of the American working class. To boost your own quarterly earnings and inflate their stock portfolios, the new executive class had to cut costs. And the biggest cost in any business, we all know, is labor. The post-war consensus was built on strong labor unions that ensured workers shared the profits of their productivity. The boomers, now entering middle management and executive roles, decided that unions had to go. They cheered when the air traffic controllers were fired in 1981, which kind of signaled the open season on organized labor. They spent the next two decades busting the private sector unions that had built the consumer base of the country. They outsourced manufacturing to countries with zero environmental or labor protections because it made their stock options pop. They turned thriving, self-sufficient American cities into rusted out husks, so they could buy cheap Chinese crap at big box stores and brag about the returns in their newly minted investment accounts. They fundamentally changed the purpose of a corporation. Before the 1980s, a corporation was basically understood to have obligations to its employees, right? Its local community, and obviously to its customers. But this boomer executive class embraced the doctrine of shareholder primacy. The only thing that mattered was the stock price. If you have to fire 10,000 workers to make the stock go up a quarter of a point for the quarterly earnings call, you did it. And you received a multi-million dollar bonus for your ruthlessness. They called that efficiency. It was not efficiency, we know now. It was extraction. And it was the strip mining of human capital. This was where the era of the corporate raider, right? This was the era of the Gordon Gekko standing at a podium in a movie theater and declaring that greed is good, a line that was meant to be a cautionary satire, but was actually adopted as a generational mantra. They financialized absolutely everything. They took companies that actually made physical products, companies that provided stable employment for thousands of families, and they subjected them to leveraged buyouts. They loaded these companies up with massive amounts of toxic debt, paid themselves exorbitant management fees, and then bankrupted the company while walking away completely insulated from the collateral damage. They turned the American economy from an engine of production into a casino. And then they rigged the casino so the house always won because they owned the house. Stock market stopped being a reflection of the actual economy and started being a mechanism for transferring money from the working class directly into the pockets of the executive class. Speaking of the stock market, we have to talk about the greatest financial sleight of hand in our modern day era, right? We have to talk about the death of the pension. So the generation that raised the boomers retired with defined benefit pensions. They worked for a company for 30 years, and the company guaranteed them a set income for life. The company bore the financial risk, right? If the stock market crashed, the company still had to pay the pension. So boomers, acting as corporate executives in the 80s and 90s, realized this was kind of a pretty big liability on their balance sheets, right? So they invented the 401k that we all know of. And they sold it to the public as a tool for financial empowerment. They told workers that they could be their own fund managers, that they could ride the bull market to untold riches. But what they actually did was they shifted the financial risk from the corporation directly onto the shoulders of the individual worker. If the market crashed the day before you retired, well, that was your problem. You should have diversified better. The executives freed up billions of dollars in pension liabilities, which they immediately used to fund corporate stock buybacks and massive executive compensation packages, that big golden parachute in the sky. They stole the security of their workers to fund their own yachts and their vacation homes. Then we arrive at the 1990s. The boomers are now in absolute control of the political and economic levers of power. The Cold War was over, the economy was booming, and thanks to the internet and the PC, they were riding that dot-com bubble and feeling like geniuses. And what did they do when this unprecedented era of geopolitical peace and economic prosperity? They deregulated the entirety of the financial industry. They repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, and it was a protective wall between commercial banking and speculative investment banking that had been put in place after the Great Depression, right? So they handed the keys to the global economy to a bunch of Wall Street gamblers and then removed all the speed limits. They created the concept of too big to fail, knowing full well that when the bets actually went bad, the taxpayers would be forced to bail them out. So then they deregulated the telecom industry, which led to massive corporate monopolies that still strangle our digital infrastructure. They passed these tough-on-crime bills that fueled the mass incarceration machine. They've locked up millions of people to build a booming private prison industry that exploited prison labor for corporate profit. That is a form of slavery. They signed free trade agreements that accelerated the complete gutting of the American manufacturing base, ensuring that younger generations would be forced into these low-wage, precarious service sector jobs without benefits or security. They transformed higher education from publicly funded public good into a massive debt-fueled profit center. So as they took over state legislatures, they systematically defunded public universities, forcing the institutions to raise tuition exponentially because they simply couldn't afford it. Then they created a system of federally backed, non-dischargeable student loans to cover that gap. They turned the pursuit of higher education into an inescapable debt trap for millennials, making sure that we would start our lives financially crippled. So during this heyday, the boomers felt really wealthy. I mean, they felt rich. Their homes were appreciating at double-digit rates year over year. Their stock portfolios were soaring into the stratosphere. They were taking multiple vacations, buying boats, remodeling kitchens with granite countertops and stainless steel appliances. But all of this wealth was really a mirage. It was not built on actual sustainable economic growth or physical productivity. It was basically built on a mountain of debt and a systematic liquidation of the country's public assets. They were cashing out the equity on the American empire, and they were spending the inheritance their parents had built, and they were putting the bill on a credit card in their children's names. So they took a massive, unsustainable credit bubble for their own personal brilliance. They thought they were rich because they were smart, but they were actually just rich because they happened to be the ones standing closest to the vault when the doors were blown off the hinges. The hubris of this era is pretty staggering to look back on. They really believed the economic boom would never end. They believed that they had conquered the business cycle through willpower and financial engineering. And they believed that the rules of economics, like the rules of history and the rules of physics, just didn't apply to them. They were the chosen generation. They consumed more resources, burned more fossil fuels, and emitted more carbon during their prime earning years than any other group of human beings in recorded history. And they knew exactly what they were doing to the environment. The science of climate change is well established, and it's actively discussed in the halls of Congress by the 1980s, right? They just didn't care. The profit margins were so good. Those quarterly earning reports were just too important. And they decided that the immediate gratification of this cheap gas, giant SUVs, and disposable consumer goods were worth destabilizing the entire global climate system. They effectively mortgaged the habitability of the planet to subsidize their suburban lifestyle and their corporate dividend payouts. Of course, with that, they also financialized the housing market, turning basic human shelter into a speculative commodity. The starter homes that they bought for peanuts in the 70s and 80s were suddenly treated as ATMs, right? They took out second mortgages and home equity lines of credit to fund their consumption habits, driving up property values, of course, to astronomical levels. Then they used their political power at the local level to create strict zoning laws, right? They prevented the construction of high-density housing that might lower their property values. They became the ultimate NIMBY generation, not in my backyard. They protected their investments by artificially restricting the housing supply, guaranteeing that their children would never be able to afford a home in the same neighborhood where they grew up. They pulled that housing ladder up so fast and so hard that they broke the rungs. By the end of the 1990s, the trap was fully set. The boomers had successfully restructured the entire global economy to serve their own immediate short-term interests. They'd slashed the taxes that funded the public sector, making sure that infrastructure would crumble and schools would fail. They had destroyed the labor unions that protected the working class, leading to four decades of stagnant wages for everyone who wasn't C-suite. And they had financialized the housing market, turning the American dream of homeownership into a nightmare of lifelong renting for the youth. They shifted the burden of retirement from the corporation to the individual, forcing millions to gamble their entire life savings in a rigged casino where the house always wins. Then they deregulated the banks and set the absolute perfect stage for the massive financial crisis that would define the next two decades. They had secured their own wealth and locked the gates behind them, right? The heyday was a period of spectacular, unbridled consumption, funded by the wholesale destruction of the American social contract, like I said. And they partied like there was no tomorrow, completely indifferent to the fact that their children would be the ones forced to clean up the mess, to pay off the national debt, and to try to survive on a planet that was rapidly becoming hostile to human life. This fortress that they inherited was now a highly leveraged, highly fortified, gated community, and the rest of us were locked outside looking at the ruins. So now we arrive at the impact crater. We talked about the pristine utopian fortress that the boomers were handed, and now we've talked about this two-decade-long financial keg party they threw in the 80s and 90s. That liquidated that fortress for cash. So now let's talk about the hangover. So the cruelest twist of this generational saga is that the people who threw the party are not the ones who are actually suffering in the hangover. They kept the cash, they kept the houses, and they handed the bill to us. This is the destruction of everything good, viewed directly through our eyes of the millennial generation. This is the reality of waking up in a world where the rules were changed the exact second you sat down at the table to play the game. So let's start with the grandest illusion of them all. We'll call it the promise. If you're a millennial, you know exactly what the promise was, right? From the moment that we could understand our own language, we were bombarded by the boomer establishment with a very specific set of instructions. They told us if we worked hard, got good grades, participated in extracurricular activities, and went to a four-year university, we would be guaranteed a slot in the middle class. Now, this wasn't presented like a gamble, right? It was presented like it was a physical law of the universe Sign on the dotted line, take on the student debt, and the system will reward you with a career, a mortgage, and a two-car garage. And we didn't question it because the people telling us this were our parents. They were our teachers, right? They were our guidance counselors. We trusted them. We upheld our end of the bargain, and we became the most highly educated generation in American history. And what was waiting for us when we crossed that graduation stage? The year 2008. The Great Recession. The exact moment the boomer casino finally ran out of money. We entered the labor market at the absolute worst economic moment since the Great Depression. The financial deregulation that they had championed in the 90s had allowed Wall Street to burn the housing market completely and turn it into this massive Ponzi scheme. And they packaged these toxic subprime mortgages, they stamped them with AAA ratings and sold them on the global market until the entire house of cards collapsed. And watch how they handle the collapse, right? So this is the defining moment of the millennial perspective. When the global economy cratered because of their unchecked greed, did the boomers charge in and get into the government and hold the banks accountable and hold everything accountable to their actions? No, absolutely not. They bailed out the banks. They pumped trillions of dollars of public money, trillions and trillions, into the very institutions that had caused the problem, making sure that executive bonuses were paid out right on schedule. Meanwhile, millions of working class families lost their houses to foreclosure. And for the millennial stepping into this wasteland with our freshly printed, incredibly expensive college degrees, the doors were just locked. Entry-level jobs vanished overnight, at the same pace that they're disappearing now. The companies that had just received massive taxpayer bailouts, right, all put in hiring freezes. When they finally did start to hire again, the terms of employment had been fundamentally, permanently altered. The entry-level jobs suddenly required 3 to 5 years of mandatory experience. The salaries were dialed back, of course, to 1998 levels, but the cost of living was steadily climbing. We were told we had to pay our dues by taking unpaid internships. Think about the audacity, right? Like the assholishness of an unpaid internship. A generation that could pay for a semester of college with a summer job at a hardware store was looking us directly in the eye and telling us that working 40 hours a week for literally $0 was somehow a privilege. And they wanted our labor for free, knowing full well we had a mountain of student debt breathing down our necks. So let's talk about the student debt, right? Because it is the defining moment, the defining financial shackle, right, of the millennial experience. It's the perfect distillation of this boomer grift. As we talked about in the last segment, the boomers went to public universities that were heavily subsidized by the taxpayers. State governments viewed higher education as a public good, because it is. But as the boomers took over state legislatures, they decided that they would rather have tax cuts than fund the state university systems. They defunded public education. To make up for that shortfall, the universities had no choice but to just jack up the tuition at rates that outpaced inflation, of course. But to prevent that entire education system from collapsing, the federal government stepped in with a massive expansion of student loans. They financialized our education. They told an entire generation of 18-year-olds that it was perfectly normal to borrow $50,000, $80,000, $100,000 at 6 or 7% interest. Then they made these loans non-dischargeable in bankruptcy.
Yeah.
Even if you declare bankruptcy, there's no way out of the student loan. Sorry. They created this inescapable financial track. We started our adult lives with a negative net worth so staggering that it completely changed the entire trajectory of our existence. Our generation delayed getting married. Our generation delayed having children. We delayed buying homes. We did not delay these things because we're lazy, right? Or because we wanted to travel the world and find ourselves. We delayed them because a massive portion of our monthly income was being automatically garnished to pay for an education that the previous generation got for the price of a used Honda Civic. Hey there, Overlap listener. Thank you so much for tuning in thus far to this episode, Silver Tidal Wave Part 1. This is the end of Part 1. We will return next week with Part 2 of Silver Tidal Wave, and you can pick up the rest of the episode there. Make sure that you are subscribed to us on wherever you're listening to this podcast, and make sure if you have the opportunity, please rate us. 5 stars would be my preference, but whatever you feel is necessary, give us a good old rating. That helps the algorithm find podcasts like this for people like you. Thanks so much for being here, and we will see you next week for the conclusion of the Silver Tidal Wave.